It's terminated correctly in its surge impedance. Remember, the characteristic impedance is also known as surge impedance from a previous discussion. There is no standing wave because there is no reflected wave on the line. Maximum power will then be fed to the load. Okay, so if you have an SWR of whatever it is, you're not going to get the full power going to the load. Of course, the wave is going to be reflected back. So now that we're going to talk about the formation of standing waves. Well, let me let it drop. Okay. The formation of a standing wave is an interesting phenomenon. Actually, the standing wave does not change either in phase or position for a given transmission line length. With a given termination, generator operating conditions and frequency. All right, so let me just say that again. Actually, the standing wave does not change either in phase or position for a given transmission line length. With a given termination, generating operating conditions and frequency. Okay, so it does not change a phase or position, depending on, you know, that could be determined by frequency or line length or so on. So the open end of the line presents a very high impedance, and the standing wave voltage maximum always occurs at the open end of the line. The amplitude of the standing wave changes as the phase of the direct and reflected waves along the line vary with time. However, the position and phase of the standing wave remains constant. Yeah, because you're not changing the, let me just go back a second, because it's not a direct result for either transmission line length with a given termination, generator operating conditions, and frequency. So the position of the phase of the standing wave remains constant. And there's a couple of figures here which actually show that, which again, I can't show you over the air, but again, you have to visualize a wave going in one direction and a wave going in an opposite direction, and they're algebraically adding and subtracting from each other at any given point. So let it drop. Any questions up to this point? W82CDO. Okay. Seems like the static has calmed down a bit. So in one of the figures here, it shows the formation of a standing wave on an open line. The open end of the line acts at a very high impedance. You gotta see this as an original wave, followed by a dashed line, a reflected wave, followed by a dotted line, and they're assuming that there are no losses in the line, so the reflected wave is of equal amplitude too, but 180 degrees out of phase with the original wave. Therefore, the result in showing by a solid line is zero. Again, I'm just reading this, but you know, you have to again visualize this if you want to. Alright, so I'm going to bypass the figures here, and let's see if I can explain this without you seeing these diagrams. And this is a little bit tricky. Alright, W82CDO, just letting it drop. Alright, so they talk about what you actually see here as far as the standing wave changes along the line. And these bunch of figures, I got A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 figures here. Each, by the way, in a standing wave, the wave is actually a sine wave because we're putting an AC signal at whatever frequency that we're putting in into the piece of coax cable. So, you know, it could even be a 60 cycle a signal, and that's your line frequency, which I think most people know. But on the sine wave itself, the positive peak of the sine wave, they call it a loop, L-O-O-P, and the valley where it goes to zero is called a node. So they have loops and nodes along the line. And they identify those because it's a little bit easier to describe as these waves move along the line or appear to move along the line. So they make it easier to describe it that way. So let me just stand by a second. I just want to read on a little bit here. Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit hard to explain it without actually seeing what they're talking about, and that's what I'm looking at here. Again, this is the formation of standing waves. So, all right, getting away from the actual diagrams, the impedance along an infinite line or along a line matched by a termination equal to its characteristic impedance is constant when measured at any position along the line. However, on a mismatched line, the impedance along the line varies in accordance with the standing waves of the voltage and current. So at the open end of the line, the voltage is maximum and the current is at minimum. That holds true for a dipole antenna, your simple, half-wave dipole. Your voltage nodes, as they say here, a voltage node or a voltage loop, one being a peak, one being a valley, your impedance is very high at the ends of your half-wave dipole. So, at the center of the dipole, your voltage is low, but your current is high at the feed point of the dipole, and that's usually the way it is for a properly tuned and adjusted half-wave dipole. So you have your minimum voltage in the center and your maximum voltage at the ends. And you've heard stories about people that have dipole antennas that actually caused some fires at the ends of the dipole where the insulators are, because they're arcing, because the voltage is so high, they can actually arc to the rope or trees or whatever it's connected to the dipole, and you can start a fire. And we've seen pictures of those over various times and locations. So as I said, at the open end of the line, the voltage is at maximum and the current is at minimum. Our basic impedance formula tells us that impedance is equal...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Thank you, timeout again. Actually, it's my fault, I'm talking too much. Our basic impedance formula tells us that the impedance is equal to E divided by I, which is a very, basic Ohm's law formula. Hence, the impedance at the open end of the line and all voltage loops is maximum. That's a high voltage divided by a small current. That's E divided by I. The voltage is at maximum, the current is at minimum. As we proceed back along the line from the opened end towards the generator, the voltage decreases and the current rises. Until 90 degrees later, we find that the current is maximum and the voltage is at minimum. So now it's just the opposite. Again. At this point, the line impedance is very low, because when you have a low impedance, you have a higher current and you have a minimum voltage. So at this point, the line impedance is very low. It's a low voltage divided by a large current. Okay, at this point, let me just let it drop, because I'm trying to go slow, if people are interested in, hopefully following what I'm saying. This is WH2CDL. All right, I hope I have a little audience out there anyway. Either that or everybody's sleeping. When a radio signal is sent down a line shorted at the far end, the standing wave pattern on the line are as shown in, again, another figure, figure 9. The reflection, of course, again starts from the far end or termination. In this case, the termination is a short circuit, rather than an open circuit. And the voltage is minimum at the shorted end, because now it's shorted rather than open. An open circuit, the voltage will be maximum. A shorted line, the voltage will be minimum. It'll be just the opposite. But the same effect occurs, as I just explained. All right, so 1/4 wavelength back. By the way, 1/4 wavelength is 90 degrees on a sine wave, because you have four quarter wavelengths to make a full wavelength. 9, 18, 180, 27, 270 degrees, and 360, 360 degrees. And that's your full sine wave, by the way. And just for information. I'm not reading that, I'm just telling you that. So 1/4 wavelength back from the end of the line, the voltage reaches the maximum and the current falls to a minimum. The voltage maximum occurs at the termination of the open circuit line and the current maximum at the termination of a short-circuited line. With a short-circuited line, the separation between voltage loops and current loops are also 1/2 wavelength apart, just like before. So it's just the opposite as far as current and voltage, but it's the same concept and the same idea. It's just that it's 180 degrees different than what it was with an open line. And I'm just saying that. So now here's a question. Now, what is the effect of using terminating resistance values that are slightly higher or lower than the surge impedance value? That's a question. All right. I'll ask that question. Anybody know? Before I give the answer here. So, what is the effect of using a terminating resistance value that are slightly... anybody have an answer for that, or a partial answer?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
KD2FIU.
Okay, George, go ahead.
Voltage lagging, current lagging, balance out on your element. Is that correct, Andy?
Well, let me read on and see if I could what's the word I'm thinking of, diagnose the way you said it, because it, let me just go on here. So now it says, what is the effect of using terminating resistance values that are slightly higher or lower than the surge impedance value? If the terminating, unfortunately, we're going to figures here. As shown in figure 10B, the amplitude of the standing wave is never as great as for the completely open circuited line, as shown in this other figure. So, let me just read on one more paragraph here. The amplitude, less voltage or less current, depending on the ratio between the surge impedance and the terminating impedance. And this is how we get into the SWR formulas. So if the impedance of the termination is only slightly higher in value than the surge impedance, the amplitude of the standing wave is small. If it is substantially higher, the standing wave will have a higher amplitude. Furthermore, the standing wave does not drop to zero, because the phase of the original wave and the reflected wave are such that the two never completely cancel. How the terminations are higher or lower, a shorter termination, an open termination, your Emax and Emin, and so on. So basically, George, so what you said is, as you said, Emax, Emin, and so on, or Imax and Imin. Okay, so you got that, George? You understand that?
WACCDO, KD2FIU. Yeah, that's the way I understood it. And the way I see it is that you need very, very strong matching systems if you don't have an element to start with to work on the frequency that you want your transmit receiver to work on. So, yeah, we're on the same page here. The reactance has got to be controlled on the elements. Thank you, Andy.
Okay, well, that's actually, you know, that's the reason why we have a SWR formula, because you're reaching either a maximum value or a minimum value, as depending on what load, the value of the load impedance-wise compared to the surge impedance or characteristic impedance of the cable, the transmission line itself. We're talking about, you know, terminating, you know, again, the topic is, you know, lines that are terminated but not matched in its own characteristic impedance. These are mismatched loads. Basically, that's why I'm mentioning this. So your basic SWR formula is your E max over E min, which is your voltage. E is your voltage and I is your current. Maximum voltage divided by maximum minimum volts. I'll say it again. Maximum voltage divided by minimum voltage is your SWR. As one formula that's used. And there's a few others that could be used as well. So, and mismatched loads, return loss, and I can expand it into Smith charts and what a Smith chart looks like, and reflection coefficient, and all these other formulas. But right now, I'm trying to keep it, you know, simple as far as what SWR is, and how it's formed, as I just explained. I just wish you could see these pictures because it would clarify. All right, let me let it drop. Any other questions? It's already 9:30. This is WA2CDL.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Okay, is that John?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I was just wondering if you wanted to mention reflection coefficient, because the reflection coefficient sort of leads you right into the SWR. I was just wondering if you had a comment about that.
I'm just looking ahead a little bit here, because there's did I mention reflection coefficient? You know, again, just keep in mind, I'm trying to simplify this whole discussion as a basic start. Later on, we can get into reflection coefficient, but I don't see that here. There's a few more pages to go through, which I'm not going to go through all of them today, because, you know, it gets a little bit more involved, as you understand. But I don't see that here, but we can, you know, I have other books on reflection coefficient, which I can talk about, but right now I just want to get these basic concepts down and understood. John, back to you.
Oh, sounds good, Andy. Okay, fine business. Thanks.
Yeah, if I jump too far ahead, then even it'd be hard to get. You know what I mean? Okay. So as I mentioned, let me just go back here, because I'm looking at an earlier paragraph. So we were talking about the terminating resistance being either higher or lower than the characteristic impedance of the coax cable. And that consequently causes the amplitude of the reflected wave to be either higher or lower depending on the resistance, the terminating resistance. But I also see. However, the phase of the standing wave is the same as for a completely open circuited termination. In other words, although it does not reach zero, it reaches a minimum at the same point as the standing wave on an open circuited line. So let me drop at this point. Yes. sort of tiptoeing through the tulips around this little discussion here with this. When the impedance of the line termination is lower than the surge impedance, the phase of the standing wave is the same as that of a short-circuited line. And there's, again, another diagram which shows that. A resistive termination just slightly less than the characteristic impedance of the line develops a low amplitude standing wave. Let's repeat that because I was just reading ahead a little bit. A resistive termination develops a low amplitude standing wave, while a termination appreciably less than the surge impedance develops a higher amplitude standing wave. Again, the wave does not ever reach zero. So again, you know, it depends on the determination, the ratio of the termination's resistance compared to the resistance or impedance, I should say, of the transmission line. And I keep thinking 50 ohm because most people, we know about 50 ohm lines, and we want a 50 ohm load, and when the load is matched to 50 ohms to 50 ohm line, you get your maximum power. So the reason why we're mentioning all this is because we have a ratio, and there is a formula, which I just mentioned before, which is a standing wave ratio. And that is the extent of the mismatch between the line and the termination is indicated by the ratio of the maximum to minimum value of voltage along the line. Now, we're talking about voltage because, as I mentioned, it's going to be Emax divided by Emin. But you can also have Imax divided by Imin, which is the current ratio. So we're going to be talking about, most of the time, it's referred to voltage, as we know, because we call it VSWR. V is voltage. We never really call it ISWR. Reflected wave travels and adds to algebraically to the forward wave, as mentioned earlier. So we're talking about VSWR, which is a voltage ratio.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, that was perfect timeout. And by the way, I wasn't reading that, I just said that from my own, you know, thoughts. The extent of the mismatch between the line and the termination is indicated by the ratio of the maximum value to the minimum value of the voltage along the line. The ratio can also be given for current, as I just said. The voltage standing wave ratio, however, is the more common. Okay, so it's actually repeating what I just said, and I just said it out of my own words. Now that I'm reading ahead, they're repeating what I just said. The voltage standing wave ratio, however, is the more common, because you don't really hear the term ISWR. You always hear VSWR. The formula to use to find the voltage standing wave ratio, which is usually abbreviated, as I just said, VSWR, is as follows. It is Emax divided by Emin, and E is the voltage maximum divided by the voltage minimum. And here's an example. For example, if the minimum voltage along the transmission line is 2 volts and the maximum voltage is 4 volts, the standing wave ratio is 4 divided by 2, which is 2. So now you have a VSWR of 2 to 1 because it's a ratio. It's 2 to, it'll be 2 to something because it's always a ratio. It'll be 4 to 1, 5 to 1, 6 to 1, 10 to 1, you know, and most people have heard those, you know, these numbers. Oh, I have a VSWR of 5 to 1. Or they could just say, I have a VSWR of 5. Well, 5 doesn't really mean anything because you have to keep it in that ratio aspect. It's 5 to something. So here's an interesting point in regard to that. Let me let it drop. A standing wave ratio of 2 indicates that the load resistance is either twice as high as the characteristic impedance of the line, or one half as high. Now, it just so happens that I know this for a fact. So, if you took an SWR meter, like a bird watt meter, well, actually, one thing about a bird watt meter, bird watchers are not calibrated. Their meter scales are not calibrated as SWR, as a ratio. Not like 2-1, 3-1, 4-1. It is an SWR meter. It is a directional coupler. As we know, it's been mentioned many times. But bird has a mammograph, which converts the ratio of the reflected and forward power, or I should say the ratio of forward to reflected power, correctly saying it, and you put these numbers into the mammograph and you will come up with an SWR number. And Bird supplies that. I happen to have that mammograph that you can purchase from Bird. So their watt meters are calibrated as far as watts forward and watts reflected, not an SWR ratio. But again, you can convert that very easily. So we know that if we see an SWR of 2-1, we know that our termination now will be either twice or half as our characteristic impedance. So if I put a 100-ohm resistor across the 50-ohm piece of coax cable, I'm going to have an SWR of 2-1. Or, consequently, if I put a 25-ohm resistor across the piece of cable that's got a 50-ohm impedance, again, I'm going to have a SWR of 2-1. All right, so that can you just keep in mind, and that'll give you a reference point. Oh, consequently, and I probably will say this here, if the load resistance is on the high side of the characteristic impedance, the voltage drop would be located at the termination. For the load resistance lower than the characteristic impedance, the voltage minimum and current maximum will be at the present at the termination. So, let's see, it would be at the termination. This will be low resistance. I'm just reading this over again, just so I can get it, which makes sense. So, given what I just said, as you have learned, the amplitude of the standing wave of voltage on the line depends on the impedance mismatch between the characteristic impedance of the line and the load. Therefore, you can also use...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W2CDL, let me let it drop. All right, continuing. Therefore, you can also use the ratio of the impedance of the line to the load resistance to compute the voltage standing wave ratio. If the load resistance is larger than the surge impedance, compute the VSWR by using the following formula. Now, okay, it'll be RL, which is load resistance to the load, divided by the impedance of the line. So if the load resistance is smaller than the surge impedance of the formula, then we just use the opposite. So if the load resistance is larger than the line, or I should say that than the surge impedance, we use the formula load resistance divided by the impedance of the line. If the load resistance is smaller than the surge impedance, then we just flip the equation around, and now VSWR is the ZO, which is the impedance of the line, divided. So, here's an example. Since the load resistance is smaller than the line impedance, we would use the second formula, ZO over RL, and that comes out to, that's 150 divided by 50, which is 3. So we now have an SWR of 3-1. 3-1, by the way, will tell you, as I mentioned earlier, a 2-1 SWR will show the load impedance either being twice or one-half. A 3-1 will be the load impedance would be 3 times as high or one-third as high. So going in both directions, you'll have 150 ohms instead of 100 ohms. That's 3 times. Which will give you an SWR of 3-1. All right, let me let it drop. Any questions up to this point? We're almost, it's just about that time. We've got about 5 more minutes or so. We're almost done with this, and then we can continue next time. Any questions about VSWR up to this point?
KD2FIU, Andy. Yeah, this is a great lead up to impedance matching with lines. I liked it. This is good. That's what I'm thinking about here. But lost with basic SWR is that we got the positive divided by the negative, and you've got the reflected power and the forward power divided by the negative of the reflected power and the forward power. So what I'm seeing there is that impedance does not have to be 100%, that the SWR is going to be the rule in running your element, your radiating element, your antenna device itself.
Well, that's a different discussion as far as matching an antenna to a piece of coax, whatever coax it is. And the types of matching, see, that's another discussion, and that's also in this QST article. I'm going to be getting there eventually, but right now, I got to get through this part. But as far as the driven element of an antenna and the way it's matched to that driven element, that's that will be discussed further. But right now, just to get the concept down of voltage maximum to. So, it's Vmax divided by Vmin, and the ratio between your voltages and your characteristic impedance of your coax cable, which will give you your SWR value. It's 2 to 1, 3 to 1, 4 to 1, and any value in between. So I'm just sticking with that. All right, let me finish up one more paragraph tonight to digest this stuff. And then next week, we'll go into reflectometers, which is an interesting discussion, and then transmission lines as circuit elements itself. Now, here's where we get into that original discussion, transmission lines as circuit elements parallels the impedance matching with transmission lines subject that I took out of QST. So that'll be the next discussion in this book that I'm using. Okay, so that's the very reason why I went to this book in the first place. So, to finish up, the measurement of the standing wave ratio along the transmission line is a reliable method for determining whether or not the load impedance is matched correctly to the transmission line. The absolute value of the standing wave ratio indicates the seriousness of the mismatch. A low standing wave ratio indicates a slight mismatch, while a high standing wave ratio shows a very serious mismatch. The standing wave ratio and efficiency of a transmission line system can also be judged by comparing the incident and reflective powers. I'm talking about, when you say powers, radio, power in watts, or how much power is going to the antenna. The incident power is the energy that is passing down the line from the transmitter to the load.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, WHCDL, let me let it drop. Okay. The reflected power is the energy that is reflected back up the line from the termination because of a mismatch. An instrument referred to as a, reflectometer. There's the word again. Okay, I just wanted to just make sure that they're using the same word. An instrument referred to as a reflectometer can be used to compare the incident and reflected powers, thus giving an ideal indication of line inefficiencies, and that's line efficiencies, and power output. Most television and FM transmitters use this method for checking transmitter output power and efficiency. that I use a reflectometer because, you know, the high power transmitters from your radio and television stations use that method because the power is so much higher. You just can't put a bird watt meter. Actually, you can. There are coax cables, if you want to call it that. I'm trying to think of the name for it because I forgot the name. But up at the World Trade Center, where the broadcast transmitter is, where you actually see a line section that has a bird's lug in it, and they sample some of the power, and they monitor the power that way, at that location, remotely, back at the station or studio, to know how much power is coming out of the transmitter. The bird makes these line sections that have built-in directional couplers that accommodate the slugs, the bird watt meter slugs. And it is the exact same slugs they used on the smaller bird 43s that we're familiar with. It's just much higher power. They make slugs up to 10,000 watts or more, even 50,000 watts. So, you know, depending on the design of the slug. Okay, I just thought I'd add that in. With that, it's 10 to 10, so approximately 1 hour. I think we'll stop from here at this point, see what you absorbed so far, what you're absorbing, and then we'll continue next week. Because, as I said, there's reflection coefficient that John said, which we can get into later on, and other discussions. The main thing is the transmission lines and circuit elements. So that'll become an actual element because of the way the line behaves, either matched or mismatched. So we'll go from there. That's it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Alright, let me just make sure I still have it. Let me wait to see the other. Okay. That's it. That's probably my last timeout for the night. Roy, thank you again. And always to be continued. It's getting more interesting as time goes on. Thanks, guys, for listening. Hope I didn't put everybody to sleep. AC2GS, W8CDO. Go ahead, Roy.
KD2FIU.
Yes, you want me.
Andy, great job, thank you. Stimulating a lot of stuff, and I'm sorry for jumping in, but that was a really great job, and a lot of things I were learning in the past, and you were filling in on. Thank you, KD2FIU.
All right, well, I'm trying to give you bite-sized pieces to. The stimulation, and it's all interesting. It's all interesting, as Dick said, as Dick used to say, it's all interesting jazz. All this stuff. Okay, very good. Thanks, George. Have a good night. Roy, back to you. And I won't hold it up any further. AC2GS, WHCDF.
And thanks,
Jim. Yes. Yeah. You want me too?
No, that was the correct.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Let me check that I have it. Yep, I have it. Okay, this is AC2GS, and thank you very much, Andy, for Andy's Corner. I'm looking forward to next Sunday night for the next installment, and you're doing a great job. Wesley. If you have a question, Ken, WB2KWC, wanted to ask one earlier. So if you don't mind, I'll take Ken's question first, and then we'll go back to you.
Perfect, you please. I have this science question.
Okay, Ken, do you have a question tonight?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Roy. It's about my, I guess, fascination with COVID-19. Recently, I was reading a report of a patient that was reported to have contracted COVID-19 for the second time after recovering from his first case. Now, first of all, I'm assuming this is the truth. And it got me to thinking about how it affects the testing of a COVID vaccine. It seems that all of the vaccine testing measured whether a person developed antibodies. Am I correct in assuming that now there is some question about whether developing antibodies is an effective way of testing the efficacy of a COVID vaccine, or am I making a giant leap between recovering from COVID and developing antibodies? AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Okay, that's a fascinating question. Ken is talking about a gentleman from Nevada. It was written up as a preprint in a very prestigious British medical journal, The Lancet. And this guy had an infection. He was only 25 years old, living in Reno, Nevada, and he tested positive in April. And he received, supportive treatment. He got better, went home, and then a month or so later started to get sick again, got very sick, had respiratory complaints, and was tested and was positive again. So automatically everyone kind of thinks, well, maybe he just didn't resolve from the initial infection. Well, they genotyped the virus. It's two different variations of the virus. So it's a different viral strain that he got infected with the second time. So the bottom line is that even if you have antibodies, it's not a 100% sure thing. And even when it comes to testing vaccines, doctors know this. They're testing the titers of the antibodies, the change in the titers of the antibodies, but they're also testing to see whether exposure to people in the community cause these people to develop symptoms and actively reproduce the virus. So it's not only the antibodies. The antibodies being developed is a good point. It's the first point that you see in any kind of research. So that's what people are promoting, that, gee whiz, we gave it to X number of people and they all developed antibodies. But you need time to see whether the antibodies develop a significant resistance to reinfection or infection, and whether it has any side effects. There have been vaccines in the past, purely experimental, that were given to animals that not only, they did produce an antibody response, but when you expose these animals to the viruses, they got much more sick to it than if they weren't vaccinated. And some of them died. So it's a very difficult thing, testing vaccines. You know, phase three testing should take a long time. We're cutting the little corners there.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that to me. I had heard about it and was just curious.
Okay, very good, Ken. I'm sure it concerns a great deal of people because they want an end to this. And, every other week someone's coming up with either a cure or a vaccine that's going to be available in about an hour and a half. And hope is a useful thing. But if you keep on getting people's hopes up prematurely, I think it has a negative effect. We'll see. But there's a lot of different vaccines out there. They're all in the midst of testing. If one doesn't pan out, there's 100 others. So chances are favorable that given enough time, we'll find something that'll be effective. But it's going to take time. You know, these stories about how it'll be readily available before November, I don't know where they get that from. I don't know anyone who does this for a living, who has any idea how that could be done. Trump. Well, yes. It's when you mix science with politics, you get politics.
AC2QR.
Yes, Fred.
Could you speak a little bit about this
saliva test?
I'm not that familiar with this particular test. I don't know the false positives and the false negatives yet. I haven't seen any kind of documentation. I mean, the more tests, the better. What we need is more timely tests. The problem with the majority of tests that we're doing when we're doing it is that because of bureaucracies and delays and limited reagents, it takes a week to get a result, and you can't really do any significant screening and isolation because of that. So I'll look further into it, and if I can get any kind of useful information, I'll report back next Sunday.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, Wesley, you wanted to ask a question or bring up a topic?
Yes, I do. I have deficit of science part on this forum.
Okay, please ask away. This after Andy's Corner, I kind of set up as a little bit of everything. It's additional TechNet talk, it's additional science talk, it's you know, and it's virus talk.
I was puzzled once by your quote. It's not your quote, but the quote that you actually voice out. And what was this? The hen or egg. We may also think that from the perspective of physics. My question, the first, I would like to concentrate on matter. What is matter? And what is the matter made of?
Okay, it'll be rather circular, but matter is simply concentrated energy.
Perfect answer. From early times, there was a speculation what is the matter and what is matter made of, and there were four stages. I could recall them. That was earth, water, air, and fire, but it was from Greek time, 450 BC, and that was made by Aristotle. But then we have a Max Planck, but before that we have a, well, actually Max Planck is important here, a discoverer of energy, quanta, won him a Nobel Prize in Physics in 1918, and he was the father of quantum theory. There was one more quote I would like to say, okay, about the matter. In chemistry and physics, atomic theory is a scientific theory of nature, of matter, which says that matter is composed of discrete units called atoms. And we may also go to Wikipedia, which would state that matter is everything that has mass, and that requires additional explanation from Dr. Roy, because I only mentioned one factor. So atoms practically are included in description of matter, but photons not, because they don't have mass. And to actually end Dr. Roy.
Okay, photons do not have, usually the fudge word is rest mass. It has an inertial equivalent, and so it can impart momentum. So you have to kind of wrap your head around something that has no particular mass. How could it possibly have momentum? Because momentum tends to be a quantity based on mass times velocity. But the theory of the atom goes all the way back to the Greeks. I mean, just because Aristotle got it wrong doesn't mean the Greeks got it all wrong. The concept of an indivisible object with an inherent characteristic being an atom goes back to the same place in Greece. And as alchemists in the Dark Ages moved up through the Renaissance and got smarter and smarter, they realized how things seemed to go together. In the 1800s, you had the periodic table, and you had predictions of elements that would be fitting between known elements. We found helium on the surface of the sun before we saw it any place on the Earth, so there's a long history for that. But there are forces that have mass, that have weight. The weak nuclear forces have significant mass. So it's not just energy or force carriers are all massless things. So it just makes things more complicated.
Okay, I'm going to add something to it. So in classical physics, general chemistry, matter is any substance that has mass and takes up space by having volume. All everyday objects can be touched and ultimately composed of atoms which are made up of interacting subatomic particles. And in everyday as well, a scientific usage of matter generally includes atoms and anything made up of them and any particles or combination of particles that act as if they have both rest mass and volume. However, it does not include massless particles such photons or other energy phenomena or waves such as light or sound. Matter exists in various stages, also known as phases. Let me drop. Those include classical everyday phases such as solid, liquid, and gas. For example, water exists as ice, liquid, water, gaseous, steam, but other states are possible, including plasma, Bose-Einstein condensate, Fermi condensate, and quark gluon plasma. And that's from Wikipedia matter. But now, let me go further. And I'm gonna make some complication to it. Somehow, even though that we aren't entirely sure, we have a question about matter and antimatter in universe of the past. So, confusing part is that symmetry between matter and antimatter in terms of particle physics is more explicit than some of you might think. I'm going to give you an example. Every time we create quark, we also create anti-quark. Every time quark is destroyed, an anti-quark is destroyed. Every time we create or destroy lepton, we also create or destroy an anti-lepton from the same lepton family. And every time the quark or lepton experiences an interaction, collision, or decay, the total net number of quarks and leptons and the end of the reaction, the quarks minus anti-quarks, leptons minus anti-leptons, is the same. And the end, at the end, it was like it was at the beginning. Would that somehow explain a question matter and in universe as, let me formulate it differently. The only way we made more or less matter in the universe has been to make more or less antimatter in the equal amount. Do you agree with that part?
Well, the problem is that so far science has yet to figure out any place where all that antimatter might have gone, where it's not blowing up galaxies by mutual annihilation. So physicists believe that there is a very small amount of antimatter in this universe of ours that are being created by spontaneous decay and collisions and high energy action. But that there is an imbalance in matter versus antimatter in this universe, and the guy who proves the pathway for this lopsidedness is going to win at least one Nobel Prize.
Would that be your reaction to the question, how did the matter in our universe arise from nothing? And we talking in from only from physics perspective. And Trixia.
Well, you'd get an argument among physicists of whether or not energy came from nothing. We've sort of talked in the past that the concept of conservation of energy only works if you have a stable universe, which we don't. The moment that the universe changed volume, and it did it from its birth, apparently, true conservation of mass energy went out the window. So as the volumetric, the volume of the universe expands, at the very least the vacuum energy increases constantly. And so there's a lot more energy at the end of the 13.8 billion years than there was a couple of hours after. Although there was a lot of energy during the bang, and no one can quite explain why, but as we've talked before on the science talk, that about 99% of the photons that are shooting all over the sky and the space were generated by the Big Bang. It's been redshifted all the way into the microwave region, which is why the sky is black and not bright white.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
So, are we saying that gravity, is that alternative energy? Or maybe that's the way I understand it. I could be wrong.
Well, you could make a case that gravity in it itself is not actually a form of energy. It's the curvature of space-time itself. But there are people, I tend to kind of call them accountants, they believe that there are such things as positive energy and negative energy. So in other words, gravitational forces where they've been acted upon, so that instead of each little grain of sand is suspended in space by itself, it's coalesced into large collections of massive objects, is a kind of negative form of energy. So some physicists will say that if you take all the negative potential gravitational energy, it's balanced by the positive energy of all the things going on in the universe. I think that's playing games with math, and these are guys that I wouldn't let fill out my tax form.
Well, as energy expands, doesn't energy contract?
No. The problem is that the law of conservation of mass energy is limited to a static situation for a very short time period. If you take in the time period of the universe, if you take in the expansion coefficient of the universe, the concept of conservation of mass energy gets thrown away, so that as time goes on and the universe expands outward, each cubic volume has a low-level vacuum energy due to quantum mechanics. So the total energy of the universe is always going up. It's not going up and down, because that wouldn't make that much sense. It's always going up. You can't really tap into vacuum energy, because you have to take energy from a high level to a low level in order to extract work from it. And since vacuum energy is the lowest